Okay, great. Good morning, everyone. We can go ahead and get started. Welcome to today's webinar on financial engineering. I'm Audrey Melville, the marketing director here at Gabelli Funds and your moderator for today's session. I'm thrilled to be here today with my colleague, Chris Marangi, who will help us understand what is financial engineering and how it is used in today's investing environment. For those of you that aren't familiar, Gabelli Funds is an asset management firm founded by Mario Gabelli in 1976. And today we manage over $30 billion in assets across a broad set of asset classes and investment vehicles. Our dedicated team of analysts and portfolio managers conduct fundamental bottoms-up research utilizing our firm's private market value with a catalyst investment approach. Chris Marangi joining me today is our co-CIO of value at Gabelli, as well as a portfolio manager on several of our mutual funds and separately managed accounts. Chris has over 28 years of industry experience and is an expert on the topic of financial engineering and has written two white papers on the topic, which we will distribute after the webinar. So Chris, before we dive into our discussion around financial engineering, can you tell us a little bit more about your background and how you became so well-versed in this investing concept?
Great. Thanks, Audrey. Glad to be here. So yeah, I started my career in investment banking and private equity, where I was on the other side of the table in actually executing on some of these transactions. And then in business school, I took a class with Professor Bob Willens, who is known as the guru to Wall Street on a lot of these concepts. That single class probably paid for my business school education. But then I got to really put it to work when I joined here 21 years ago, which was coincident with the time that Liberty Media, which is a media conglomerate essentially put together by Dr. John Malone, started to rationalize itself. And they really are among the best practitioners of financial engineering in the world. They've done a dozen spinoffs, three cash-rich split-offs, some reverse Morris trusts, seven tracker stocks, four rights offerings. These are all concepts hopefully we'll talk about today, but really had to learn and got to see these things firsthand as they have been used to surface value.
Great. Thanks for telling us a little bit more about your background. And I can see how all of those transactions would really provide a lot of real world experience. So to kick off our discussion, can you explain to our audience the concept of financial engineering and how it impacts the work that we do here at Gabelli?
Yeah, so corporate activity, whether that's M&A or reshuffling of assets, is really critical to the functioning of the capitalist system. You get to the world changes, obviously, sometimes you need to make changes, refocus management, et cetera. The issue or the constraint with doing that is taxes. As you come to learn pretty quickly, the government is a partner in pretty much everything that you do. And obviously, we try to find ways to minimize that partner's share of the hard work of companies and individuals. From a firm's perspective, we really focus on the individuals and being tax efficient. We have this motto, it's not what you make, it's what you keep. So we are very tax sensitive in the way we manage portfolios, but corporations, hopefully, and the ones that we are focused on generally are also very tax sensitive and trying to minimize the taxes at the corporate level as well as for their taxable shareholders. And so they employ a number of techniques that we'll talk about today, reorganizations, the use of publicly traded partnerships, SPACs, et cetera, to accomplish those goals.
Great. That's a really helpful overview. And so you mentioned a couple of those different types of transactions. And so when you think about those, how do reorganizations such as spinoffs or splitoffs serve as a tool for unlocking value in a company?
Yeah. So without nerding out too much on the tax code, before the repeal of the General Utilities Doctrine in 1986, if a company owned two subsidiaries, call it, Gizmo and Widget, and those didn't fit together anymore, and you wanted to separate one, you could do that with very little immediate tax consequences. But since then, a distribution of one of those businesses to shareholders could potentially be taxable unless it meets certain requirements of the tax code. Actually, it's section 355 of the tax code that includes several requirements, among them the control requirement, which is that a company must have control of the subsidiary before it's spun. Another is that you have to have an actively managed trade or business 5 years prior to the spinoff. And a third being that the spinoff can't be a device to avoid taxes. And that has some consequences for what happens to the spin post-transaction. So anyway, so we put all those together And obviously, tax lawyers and bankers carefully craft spinoffs so they meet those requirements. There are a few actually special cases that we might talk about of spinoffs. Those are, I mentioned earlier, cash-rich splitoffs, which is a case where a company A might own stock of company B, and company A can essentially trade that appreciated company B stock back to company B for cash, as long as it includes an active trader business on the other side. And that's been used on rare occasion. It's a pretty exotic transaction, but it's one of the reasons, for example, that Berkshire Hathaway owns Duracell today, because they did a cash rich split with Procter & Gamble, which is the prior parent of Duracell. And then there are also reverse Morris Trusts, which you see a bit more frequently. And that is essentially the combination of a spinoff with a merger. So in that case, company A might want to spin off their subsidiary, and they would immediately merge it into another publicly traded company. The key requirement there is that the shareholders of company A must have greater than 50% of the vote and value of the new company. And we've seen that used in a number of cases. One of the more recent cases, and one we follow closely, was AT&T, which owned Time Warner, did a reverse Morris Trust of that business into Discovery Communications, which was at the time a standalone company, and that became Warner Brothers Discovery, WBD, in the markets today.
Got it. Fascinating. No, those are some really, really great examples that I think demonstrate both the power of, you know, financial engineering to unlock value, but also the, you know, experience and knowledge required to navigate some of those intricacies. Next, I'd like to discuss some more of the specific techniques and strategies that you've touched on. So can you explain a little bit more about how rates and MLPs alter the investment landscapes and investor returns?
Yeah, sure. So I think it's important to understand that most corporations today, most companies, publicly traded companies, are what are called C-Corps. And that involves two layers of taxation. So a company, corporation gets taxed on its own earnings, and then went to the extent that it distributes those earnings to shareholders, those shareholders, if they're taxable, pay taxes on those distributions, those dividends. So one way to end up with a single layer of taxation is to create a partnership. And the tax code includes some special provisions for companies that are either real estate or natural resource-based companies to eliminate one layer of taxation. In the former, those are called real estate investment trusts, REITs, very popular. There's an income test and an asset test, and basically 75% of your income and assets have to be related to real estate, things like rent or mortgage interest. And that, over the last decade or two, has been pretty widely expanded to include things like rent from renting billboards or towers or even fiber. Over the years, we've also seen the development of what are called OpCo PropCos. So where a hotel operations company would separate their underlying real estate, and that would be the PropCo, the property company, that would basically rent the property to the operating company that would actually run the hotel or the casino. The IRS has tightened up some of the rules around OpCo PropCo, so you don't see that happening as much. And then you've got MLPs, which has existed for a long time. And basically, MLPs are similar to REITs. They distribute their earnings to shareholders with one layer of taxation. The key requirement there is that they have to derive it that income primarily from essentially natural resources, whether that's pipelines, which is probably one of the more common ones, or other processing of natural resources. We've also seen a number of companies create what are called yieldcos. This was popular a few years ago with utilities, where they would drop down some of their generating assets into another company, and they kind of looked and felt like an MLP. They weren't actually MLPs, but they were primarily dividend-generating entities, and they were capitalized as such. I should mention that this craze to create more and more REITs and MLPs and some of the other techniques we'll talk about was dampened a bit by the reduction in the corporate tax rate, which just made the gap a little narrower. Obviously, that all could change, and we could see reacceleration of financial engineering, but that's been the history over the last several years.
Got it. That's really interesting. Are there any specific businesses that related to either of those that you've worked on recently?
Yeah, so, you know, I think it's probably important to mention that, you know, while these techniques are important, what really matters, first and foremost, are the underlying assets. And we are really looking for businesses that ideally have recurring revenue, understandable businesses run by competent management. So, you know, when we look at REITs, we're not necessarily looking at them as, you know, just kind of black boxes that produce income, but we're looking at the growth of the tower business, which has been driven by the deployment of 5G, or billboards, which is a terrific business. They continue to gain share of the overall advertising pie, for example. They just happen to be REITs, which actually makes them more attractive for certain clients.
Got it. So when you're thinking about, you know, researching companies that you might want to invest in, you're primarily looking at the fundamentals of the business and then, you know, thinking about how these impacts might impact the business in the future, as opposed to using that as like a key criteria.
Yeah, I mean, put simply, fundamentals trump tax all the time. But tax is important. It, you know, obviously is an important call on a company's earnings.
Yeah, no, that's helpful to help our audience understand how you think about the role when making investment decisions. So our conversation wouldn't be complete without discussing SPACs. So could you discuss the role and significance of special purpose acquisition companies in today's market?
Yeah, another kind of investment craze that has come and gone a number of times over the last 30 years. And you know, each version changes a little bit. And I think there is a place for SPACs in the public markets when used properly. You know, I think there were too many SPACs. They weren't being used in the right way. But, you know, SPACs, which are called, again, as you noted, special purpose acquisition companies, really have three stages. You have the capital raising stage where a sponsor will go out and raise essentially a blind pool of money. And typically the way they're structured is an investor puts in $10 per share. And for that, you get a common share and a warrant, which strikes at a higher price than, say, $10. And then the second phase is the search phase, where the sponsor basically takes that capital and they go out and look to buy a business. They try to find a business. Typically, they've got 2 years to do that. And then the third phase is, you know, what I'd call the second IPO. And that's where the sponsor brings to the shareholders a deal, a transaction that the shareholders of the SPAC can participate in, or redeem their shares and not participate in, or sell their shares to somebody else who wants to participate in that deal on the terms that have been brought to them. And that's where the sponsor really has to sell the idea. And you know, this was used a few years ago as a way to raise capital for companies that probably didn't deserve that capital, but can be used in conjunction with existing corporations to recapitalize and gain sponsorship for subsidiaries that maybe they want to get rid of. And, you know, you've seen just one current example, Lionsgate doing this. They are a studio business that owns a streaming business and cable network business that they want to distribute to shareholders. And they're doing it in conjunction with a SPAC that actually has some pretty reasonable sponsorship and credibility behind it, as well as capital. So that's, you know, one, I think, pretty effective way to use SPACs. And that'll probably endure beyond, you know, whether SPACs are coming or going.
Got it. No, that makes sense. And that's, you know, you highlighted on the fact that it's kind of, you know, been a craze that's come and gone over the past 30 years. What kind of drives the rise or fall of SPACs in the market, or, you know, the one that happened a couple years ago? SPACs were, you know,
too much money. Yeah. Too much money chasing too few opportunities. It is really a bull market product.
Okay.
You know, it's had some tweaks and it will continue to get tweaked and continue to get used, but probably, you know, comes and goes with the animal spirits of the market.
Great. I'm sure our audience appreciates that deep dive into some of those various techniques and strategies. So before we open it up for questions from the audience, can you just discuss how investors can think about the impact of financial engineering in their investment portfolios?
Yeah, I mean, this is the bottom line, obviously. And I'm not sure that was a deep dive. That was might be a shallow dive. We probably can get into some deeper questions in the Q&A. But, you know, I think there are, for us, a few sources of alpha that result from financial engineering. One is financial engineering spinoffs in particular can be a key catalyst for us. So we use this concept of private market value with a catalyst, where every company has a private market value, which we calculate in a number of ways, including what informed buyers have paid for similarly situated businesses in the past, and then the public market value, the difference between those we call our margin of safety. And we look for one or more events, we call them catalysts, that drive the public market price closer to the private price. And spinoffs are an effective way to do that. They can be used by companies to gain recognition for an asset that maybe the market isn't paying attention to better capitalize a subsidiary, and to really, you know, gain, as I mentioned earlier, management focus and really better align management incentives with that spun company. So, you know, ideally you'd want to buy a you want to invest in a situation in anticipation of the announcement of some financial engineering before the market prices that possibility in. So, you know, one just current example that we've thought about is Campbell Soup, which is a business that we like. They are in the process of acquiring a pasta sauce company, which will give their business a bit more scale. And they could follow along with many of their peers and separate their snacking company from their core soup and sauce business. And that we think would surface some value. So, you know, it's one of the reasons that we own that company. You know, as you go along the life cycle, there's obviously some lag between the time a company announces a spinoff and the time they actually execute the spinoff. And there are probably better and worse times to invest in those situations. And what we found is one of the most opportune times to invest, and this is really the second source of alpha that I referred to, is immediately after the spin, because very often a spun company will not fit in an index or will not fit with the prior shareholder group. It's typically undercovered by Wall Street and often can be an overlooked opportunity. So we found a number of little companies that have been spun off that have gone on to gain appreciation and gain a firmer shareholder base, and in many cases gone on to be acquired. And so that's the time when you want to make that kind of investment.
Got it. No, that makes a lot of sense in how you think about where to time your investment based on, you know, the possibility of some of these transactions. So I'm sure our audience appreciates that, to your point, high level overview. So I would love at this point to open it up for questions from our audience. Please feel free to submit any questions that you have in the Q&A. It looks like we already have a couple. Okay, first question from the audience. What is a tracking stock and what are some examples of current tracker stocks?
Yeah, I'm glad people were paying attention. I mentioned tracker stocks at the beginning when I was talking about Liberty Media, which has at the moment 100% market share of tracker stocks. So they've been, again, this is a technique that has sort of come and gone, come back again at various times in market history. They were very, very popular in the late 90s. And they are essentially economic but not legal ownership of underlying assets. So this is a sort of one step short of an actual spinoff of a subsidiary. And they can be used to highlight the value of a business without actually separating it. And there may be reasons why a business wouldn't get separated, chiefly because that business may not be able to fulfill the requirements of Section 355 of the tax code. In the case of Liberty Media, you know, they have a tracker structure group called Liberty Media, one that exists today, which includes Formula One and Liberty Live Nation. And for the moment, Liberty Sirius XM. Liberty Sirius XM owns 82% of Sirius XM Radio. That business is actually going to be split off technically and merged with that underlying asset, Sirius XM, later this year. That will leave two trackers. At some point, Liberty will have a second active trader business in Liberty Live, which will allow them to separate Formula One and Liberty Live as two separate C corps. So anyway, they can be used again to just highlight underappreciated assets and align management, et cetera, without actually having to go through the hoops that the IRS sets up.
Okay, got it. Really, really helpful explanation. Our next question is it true that there is a 2-year waiting period before a spinoff can be sold?
Yeah, the source of some controversy, which I don't think is warranted. So the IRS essentially has a, and this is mostly established through case law, has a 2-year safe harbor that basically says once you spin off a company, if you wait 2 years, then you're free to sell it. And the reason this exists is because of one of the requirements of Section 355, the device test. You know, if you spun off a company, subsidiary A, and immediately sold it, the IRS would say, well, that doesn't smell right. You must have had negotiations with an entity to buy that subsidiary prior to spinning it off, and you're just doing this to avoid taxes. So there are some, there is a blueprint for allowing an M&A transaction happen within 2 years. And that basically says that you can have substantive negotiations. That typically is defined as negotiations about price with a buyer in the 2 years preceding. So that is before a spinoff occurs. So if you haven't had those negotiations, you're pretty much free to sell immediately. I think as a practical matter, and the history has been that most companies wait 6 months or so, and there have been a number of transactions that have happened 6, 7, 8 months post a spinoff. But so to answer the question directly, no, there is not necessarily a 2-year wait.
Got it. Okay. That's an interesting nuance. Thanks for explaining that. How do potential, you touched on some of the tax codes. So someone in the audience is wondering how the potential changes in tax law impact your view of financial engineering.
Yeah. So obviously the tax code is always changing. And I think that is one of the benefits of paying attention to financial engineering, because, you know, companies need to respond and refine their techniques in association with changes in the tax law. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, obviously the Trump tax reduction, which was a tax reduction only for corporations primarily, made some financial engineering a little less profitable, because the overall tax rate obviously went down. That is a permanent change in a tax rate unless changed by Congress. However, there are some aspects of the tax code that do phase out in 2025-6, and particularly as it relates to publicly traded partnerships, where the underlying tax rates there, or the way those distributions get treated, could make them more taxable and thus make REITs and MLPs relatively less attractive than they are today. And that could pressure some of the prices of those REITs and MLPs unless Congress steps in and extends some of the changes that have been made to the tax code under the Trump administration. So obviously always having to pay attention here. You know, that's why tax lawyers and investment bankers get paid a lot of money to stay one step ahead of the IRS.
Yeah, absolutely. Are you anticipating any changes that you'll have to think through with the upcoming election cycle?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly plenty of potential changes broadly with the upcoming election cycle. And those, I think, more often relate to a change in the stance toward M&A and antitrust. But tax is also important, obviously. And, you know, there might be a reason for companies to accelerate deal making or M&A ahead of some of those potential changes to the tax law. Again, something worth monitoring.
Got it. Okay. Do you have any comments on how will Sherry engineer her way out of Para/National Amusements?
It's a good question and a good try to get me to comment on the Paramount situation. Unfortunately, I'm not sure that this is a situation where financial engineering is necessarily all that applicable there, although it could be. And one of the impediments to an outright acquisition of Paramount is that not all of the assets are worth the same to any particular buyer. And there are certainly some regulatory impediments to some buyers like Sony from buying the whole of Paramount. Particular, Sony is a foreign corporation, can't own the CBS broadcast network or its stations, and so they need to bring in a partner there. Unfortunately, obviously, they have a lower basis, and so in theory, a separation of the stations could be taxable if not done in the right way. You know, same thing with the studio, which maybe is an asset that a number of the tech companies would love to own, but they don't want to own the cable networks. And that station, that studio, the Paramount studio, which is one of the big five original studios, has a very low basis. And a sale of that as a standalone asset would be, you know, very taxable to the corporation. Now, somebody may find it worth it just to pay those taxes to get that asset out of it. But again, these are all things we think about. But the Sherry situation, Sherry really, you know, is attempting to sell her control of the company via National Amusements. That doesn't have any specific tax consequences for Paramount.
Got it. Great. Why do you think Liberty Media utilized tracking stocks, and how do you see that structure potentially assisting other companies?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, Liberty, which has this history of rationalizing their assets in many cases as a precedent to their eventual sale, sees the value in all that, but in many cases they are restrained by Section 355. So the reason that they adopted the original tracker structure, which by the way, Liberty Braves were a part of until July of last year, when that was split off again, technically as a separate C Corp, asset-backed C Corp, it's because they didn't have they couldn't meet the requirements of Section 355. So it was sort of out of necessity. And again, as that, as those companies evolve and the situation evolves, I suspect that they won't have a tracker anymore. And that probably is something that could occur over the next couple of years. There are ways to actually buy ATBs, active trades in businesses. But again, there are some hoops that need to be jumped through to do that. As far as other companies using trackers, other companies have used trackers in the past and recently. But at the moment, really, Liberty is the only one who's currently using them. Again, in and out of fashion, I think there's probably a place for more tracker stocks and more companies should consider them.
Okay, really interesting. Member from our audience is bullish on entertainment stocks. How should I think about building a position in Live Nation compared to Liberty Live?
Yeah, interesting question. Typical of many Liberty entities where there's a Liberty entity that owns the underlying the stock of another company. And, you know, we saw this with Liberty Entertainment, which owned DirecTV and eventually merged into DirecTV, and then DirecTV was sold to AT&T. We've seen this with Liberty Sirius, where they own, as I mentioned, 82% of Sirius. They're going to merge with Sirius. So eventually the end game, I think, for Liberty Live, which currently owns, which is a tracker stock that currently owns 30% of Live Nation, is to merge that entity into Live Nation. Among the kind of tricky things there are they need an active trader business to actually separate Liberty Live from that tracker group. And again, they probably will acquire an ATB to enable them to do that. Right now, if you mark the value of Liberty Live's stake in Live Nation to market, trading at an over 30% discount. There are some other assets in Liberty Live, nothing substantial at the moment. But then the other kind of tricky part to that is this overhang of the Justice Department and what they're going to do with Live Nation, and whether they basically sue to separate the company into Ticketmaster and the promotions and venue business. That can make Liberty's life a little bit more difficult, because then they would have two stocks within the Liberty Live, Ticketmaster and the Remain Co., and have two different downstream mergers to do one day. Anyway, all things to think about, but that the discount inherent in Liberty Live is probably not entirely justified. And there's lots of things that they can do as they've done in the past to narrow and eliminate that discount.
Okay, great. Really interesting. For someone new to investing and looking to learn more, what are some of your favorite investing books for the general public?
You could go back to Security Analysis, some of the Bible of value investing, but you know, there are plenty of other books you could read. Some of the Buffett books that are out there, they're a fun read, whether it's the Roger Lowenstein book or Snowball, Alice Schroeder. You could read Bruce Greenwald's value investing book, which is sort of a little mini textbook on different flavors of value investing that features our founder, Mario Gabelli. And just read the newspaper. read the Wall Street Journal every day. And hopefully after this webinar, you'll be able to recognize some of these financial engineering techniques in play. Occasionally you'll see the press refer to things like reverse Morris Trust. Certainly you read about spinoffs a lot.
Got it. No, there's some great suggestions. Okay, let's see. What products does Gabelli offer that I can share with my clients interested in having exposure to financial engineering as a catalyst?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so we really utilize this. This is really intrinsic to our investing process. So it's really used in all of our value products. This is a kind of key consideration for us, an area that we think we can add alpha, add value to idiosyncratic value to client portfolios. So any of our mutual funds, whether it's the asset fund, the value fund, which are open-ended funds, or our closed ends like the Gabelli Equity Trust, Gabelli Dividend Income Trust. We do actually have a John Malone focused mutual fund. It's called Media Mogul, where we are investing 80% or more. It's much more of the assets in companies touched by John Malone. And that's sort of a supercharged financial engineering entity. And it's actually kind of an interesting idea today, because we are at the point where I think a lot of the financial engineering groundwork that John has laid over the last 20 years will come to fruition. Again, I mentioned a few of these things. That's the Liberty Sirius merger, a separation of Formula One and Liberty Live, potential sale of the Braves, an eventual disposition of some of the other smaller assets like Liberty TripAdvisor.
Great. While we're on the topic of entertainment, is it safe to assume that some of these topics will be discussed during our upcoming media and entertainment symposium?
They sure will. And I will certainly bring them up. And the media industry, in part because it's been subject to such drastic change recently, has been a rich area for financial engineering. And many of the companies that will be there have been the product or have conducted themselves financial engineering. So I'm sure we'll come up.
Great. Yeah, I'm sure our audience will be interested in attending that. And we'll absolutely follow up with those details after the session. What is the most interesting or the most exciting transaction that you witnessed or been a part of in your time as investor?
That's a tough question. But I mean, listen, obviously the entire saga of Liberty has been fascinating. And I actually, in my financial engineering white paper that was referred to earlier, have a small primer. It's a little bit dated on how Liberty unfolded. This was until recently a very profitable path. John Malone's returns, far exceeded those of the S&P and even Berkshire Hathaway for a number of years. They've fallen off a bit for a variety of reasons, including a disproportionate impact from higher rates and just the secular challenges of being in the media industry. One of the I think live situations that I find very interesting, one of my favorite stocks, I mentioned it here before, Liberty Braves, now called the Atlanta Braves Holding Company, actually started Liberty got control of the Braves baseball team, which is the oldest operating baseball team in North America, oldest existing sports franchise in North America, in 2016 as part of a cash rich split off with Time Warner. And that was one of the assets that was included in that package. And then it became a tracker stock. And as I mentioned earlier, was spun off last July as an asset-backed C Corp. And now is free to get sold. And we think it will get sold. And that there is a significant discount in the stock today to what it's worth to a private buyer. You're at $37, $38. You're basically paying the equivalent of, call it $2.2 billion for the baseball team. We think it's worth well over $3 billion. Over $50 a share.
Yeah, well, that'll definitely be an interesting story to follow. Okay, I think you have done a great job answering all of our questions from the audience. So with that, I thank you very much for your time today. This is a great overview on financial engineering, and hopefully we can do another one of these and maybe dive a little deeper on some of these topics.
Love to. Thanks for having me. Great. Thanks for your questions.
Thank you, everyone. Have a great afternoon.
Investors should carefully consider the investment objectives, risk, charges, and expenses of the fund before investing. The prospectus, which contains more complete information about this and other matters, should be read carefully before investing. To obtain a prospectus, please call 1-800-GABELLI or visit www.gabelli.com.
As of March 31st, 2024, GAMCO and its affiliates own 12.2% of Paramount Global Class A, 31.6% of Atlanta Braves Series A, and 5.9% of Series C, and less than 1% of all other stocks mentioned. Distributed by G Distributors, LLC, registered broker-dealer, and member of FINRA.